You're listening to the Screening in Kingston podcast. For more on Screening in Kingston, more episodes, info about our movie clubs, and a lot more fun movie content, visit screeninginkingston.com.
All right, this is going to be a week. We got some fiery news. I think I saw a movie and
I had the stomach flu.
The stomach flu, which blew off everything.
Not that this show is like a platform me just to whine about my health, but I have been sick off and on since December with various illnesses because of my baby, and probably the worst so far has been the stomach flu. I don't remember the last time I've had the stomach bug, and my friend joked, oh, probably when you were in daycare, but like George, but most likely probably in high school. It was brutal, and I'm glad it's over, but unfortunately, I just was like so, even when we were feeling better by... We kind of fell like dominoes, but we were all feeling better, I would say, by like Sunday afternoon. But even then, I'm like, I don't want to watch a movie.
By that point, you're probably just so exhausted.
Defeated.
From the weekend. Yeah, and defeated. Yeah, I could understand that. And like, especially, I was just about to ask, like, if it went through your whole house, because that's what often happens, right?
Yep.
Like, you know.
George came home from daycare Thursday night. He was fine, whatever. Then around, I want to say 10 o'clock at night, he woke up barfing and we're like, oh no. Poor guy has never barfed before. And he just looked so scared. Like, what is my body doing? Like, imagine like a little alien experiencing a bodily function for the first time. Like,
and that's what it's like having a baby.
Going on? And then he stopped barfing in the night. He was fine in the morning. We thought, okay, food poisoning. Or, you know, he ate something that didn't agree with him. Like, complete rookie parents. And anyone who's listening to the show who has multiple children or, you know, their children are all grown, they will probably laugh at us for being so naive. But we thought, okay, we're fine. His grandparents were supposed to come over that afternoon. Anyways, we're like, come on over. And then Friday night, Dan wakes up barfing. I think, oh, great. A couple hours later, I'm in the bathroom. And then we're sick. And then the following day, so, like, we text the grandparents, like, please bring us ginger ale. Mm-hmm. Like, we literally, like, we could not leave the house.
Yeah.
Not, A, because that's not good for society, but B, like, we could not be away from a bathroom. And then the next day, grandma and grandpa had it. So truly, it went through the family, and it the exact same scenario at the daycare. They all fell like dominoes. And so needless to say, yeah, movies were not really on my radar. However, last week, I was going to just kind of briefly touch upon a couple Netflix documentaries that I watched recently, and we ended up talking about Sydney Sweeney so long we didn't get to it. So what a blessing. You'll be able to hear the documentary reviews today. So it all worked out in the end, but I don't wish the stomach flu on anyone. Whew, it was a doozy, and I'm glad we're over it now and we get to be here and talk about the movie headline that I've been dying to talk to you about all week.
Well, I say we dive into it because you've got two movies to review. I have a movie and a TV show to review. So the fans who like our reviews will be very happy today, because that's mainly what we're going to do. So why don't you dive right into this headline so we can go over that.
Okay. So Joker 2 musical details, 15 cover songs. I already screwed this up. Joker, because I saw a better headline, Mike, as I was reading this headline. Joker 2, music details revealed, at least 15 cover songs, original tracks may be added. And then I saw another headline saying these are quote very well known songs. I know you have big feelings about it being a musical anyways. Before I have you weigh in, because I know you're going to have many feelings. You know what's so funny? We've known it's a musical since pretty much the sequel has been announced, or like very shortly thereafter. I never even thought about what kind of music was going to be in the musicals, you know what I mean? Like, I never even considered it being covers or original. And no, either no, one seems crazy.
I just assumed, you want to do a musical. So, like, you've written a musical, not it's a jukebox musical.
That's, which, like, explain that to people who might not know what a jukebox musical is.
Well, so a jukebox musical basically means that you have songs that are not original, often by one particular artist, and you're singing it just out of the things that you would hear on the radio. So for example, there's a musical, the Queen musical. It has like all Queen music in it. And the Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons musical has all.
Is Mamma Mia considered a jukebox musical?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know
original song. Yeah, all the plots of the musicals of a jukebox musical are always different than, like, they just use the CD, the album, if you will, or the artist
slot the existing songs. They craft the story out of the songs.
So the one of the more famous ones would be Rock of Ages, which is basically like rock music from the 80s and 90s, mainly the 80s, that's kind of like put together in the show, but there's no original music. Like, it's the hits. So, like, that's probably one of the more famous ones. Like, the Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons one is probably another one that's, like, really popular. That's probably, like, the one that I can think of that's the most successful for a jukebox musical.
Like, I didn't know if that type of musical had to have, like, an extra characteristic. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I know that Mamma Mia, for instance, like, I know those are all existing ABBA songs, but I didn't know if the jukebox portion meant that these were like top 40 hit, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I didn't know, but it's just the hits of an artist.
Yeah, of an artist, because you get the thing about, you know, ABBA being so popular, a lot of people knew their music, but I would argue that there's a handful of hits. And then there's ones that, like, fans really know, but they make it work. And the more obscure song, you often can kind of make it work within the musical, and they just kind of go for it in that way. So I would imagine if what they're saying, this is going to be more like Rock of Ages, where they're going to grab songs that fit the moments that they want it to, and have people break into songs singing those things for, like, reasons. So, yeah, that's basically what it is. And that shocks me because I wouldn't have even thought of that. Often you do a jukebox musical about one artist, right? Like ABBA, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, Queen. Like, there are others, but those are, I would say, some of the more famous ones. I think
there might even be a Britney Spears one now. Hit Me Baby One More Time, I think, is on.
Is on Broadway. Is that on Broadway now?
Or like off Broadway.
Off Broadway, is like,
I don't know. I'm not sure. But I think there seems to be a resurgence in these jukebox musicals. And
Green
I wonder
Day
if
had one. Like American Idiot was the Green Day one. There are other. And sometimes they do well and sometimes they don't. But yeah, I mean, I think I have never been more uninterested in something ever in my entire life.
It feels like a fever dream or like an ad libs. Like, it feels like something I've dreamt at. Like, I'm dreaming I'm directing the Joker movie and it turns into a jukebox musical. Like, it's, every detail that gets revealed about this movie is weirder and weirder. And I don't know what audience they're trying. So I saw one really good comment being like, I love the Joker, I love musicals, but like, I'm a very small subset of the population, and like, I don't get what they're trying to do. Essentially, like, acknowledging that there are people who like comic books and like the Joker, and there are people who like jukebox musicals, but that Venn diagram is pretty small in the middle. And so, like, are they punking us? Like, is this like a huge marketing ploy where they reveal not a musical at all? Like, Joaquin Phoenix has sung in movies, so like it's not that out there. Obviously Lady Gaga is a pop star, not that out there, but just like it's just like an odd, and 15 songs seems like a lot.
So I think 15 or 16 is sort of the Broadway standard. So usually when you do a movie adaptation of a Broadway musical, they cut it down to like 12.
Like an album.
Yeah, like it ends up being, I'm trying to remember, but like even, unless it's sung through, but like Les Mis, where so everything's in there. But.
This is going to be, unless it's very short snippets of songs, this is a very music heavy
Do you think it might be sung through, or what they call an operetta, which is where there is no dialogue? So like Les Mis?
That would be insanity.
Well, I mean,
like that's even crazier.
Hold on. Is that insanity, or is that right on the bar with everything else they're doing? Like, wouldn't that just be kind of like the next logical step? Like, you already took the Joker, made it a musical, chose to be jukebox, and said, oh, there's going to be 16 songs. Why not just sing it all the way through then?
I mean, I guess. I just... so weird. I know as the news comes out, it makes you want to see it less. It makes me want to see it more, because I'm just like, this is so bizarre. And yeah, it's also based on the stills I've seen, I can't take. It looks like they're going for very serious, very gritty, which was the first movie. I can't see how a jukebox musical, which in my, and this might be my own bias or my own lack of knowledge, but typically jukebox musicals are, from what I've seen, are pretty lighthearted.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think I've ever seen one. I'm trying to think of the, at least the popular ones. None of them, I would say, like the most dramatic it gets would be like Mamma Mia.
Right.
Which he even has a happy, not,
spoiler,
yeah.
It has a happy ending. And you know it's
sure. I'm pretty sure like still 75% of that show is an absolute just like fan fest,
fun.
Right?
Like it's, and it's like fun, a fun time. So I just can't, I don't know how I'll be able to take those musical numbers, I guess, seriously based on the tonal. I don't know. It just seems so, the headline I read earlier this week seemed so crazy. I thought that can't be true. Also, to be like, we're going to have 15 jukebox songs and then we might have original numbers. Is the movie not written? Are you not currently filming?
Yeah. Well, that was actually going to be my next question, because it sounds like they're not filming yet. But I thought they were, because they released all these stills.
Yeah,
I've shot. Seen... So they're in costume. Like, what are they doing? What are they deciding that? Like, this is what makes me not want to see it. It sounds like they're just throwing things against the wall and they don't know what
they're just
doing.
They're just letting Lady Gaga like be in character and sing, and then they're filming it, and then they went, well, that's song number 7. We'll see if she has a couple more out of her. It's so weird.
If it's little snippets of songs, then obviously they can make that work. But what I'm worrying about right now, 16, that's a lot. This show, it's a possibility that this movie is going to be
hours.
Sung all the way through. Oh, I was going to go with, I mean, I think it's going to be long too.
Oh, yeah.
But we might have like Joker, like Les Mis, but it's the Joker. Like that's what we might be setting ourselves up for here. Because 16 is a lot. And if they're like, oh, we might even have originals too. If you get up to 20 plus songs, there's no way, even in a 3-hour movie, over half of that movie is singing now. Like, well over half.
To be fair, though, Mike, they say there's going to be 15, but who's to say, you know, it's not in post-production yet, so, like, you can still edit out.
That's true.
And they do that, I think, even, you know, big movies like Les Mis, right? They will edit out songs.
I'm pretty sure that was the Les Mis we got to see in theaters was pretty much the play. So I don't think they left.
That might have been a bad example, but I don't.
But I do get what you're saying.
Out of the norm for when they're transitioning musicals to film. They might, you know, record it just like any movie. They have extra scenes. Scenes have to get cut. Whatever. But yeah, it's just wild. Just absolutely wild. I would love for our fans. I would love to do a poll to see whether or not people actually want to see this movie. I don't know if you've been reading the comments on these articles. I don't think you're much of a, you don't normally like enter the chat in terms of your, or unless I'm wrong. I don't think you don't normally read the comments on these articles.
Not usually. No.
It seems kind of a mixed bag, but I would say leaning towards people's sentiment was kind of, we were already on the fence with it being a musical, and now that we know that it's a jukebox musical, we want to see it any less. But honestly, Mike, knowing that all the songs were going to be original, I don't know if that would make me want to see the movie more. That's why I feel like I'm in such a weird state of mind, because I'm like, what's better? Existing, you know, real, no, I shouldn't say real songs, but existing pop songs? Or rock songs, who knows? Because it doesn't say the genre. That also is a complete question mark as far as I know. I don't know if you've read more about what the genres are going to be. But
no.
Is it going to be like top 40? Is it going to be rock? Because it's set in the 70s. So that would be, you know, 1970s.
When the minute I just heard that it was going to be a jukebox musical, I didn't do any research or anything, but like all I thought of was, there's no way that they're actually doing this. Like it disconnected me so much, where I honestly just feel like I'm not in the real world right now. Like it just doesn't feel like this is going to be it. I can't do it. Taylor, I can't do it. I can't go see this movie. I can't review this movie. I can't do it. This is ridiculous. I cannot believe they're doing this.
Here's
that
one
was basically
thing.
My reaction.
My page is stopping working, but I wonder if I can get back to it. I saw one song. There's a rumor, a Judy Garland song, the 1953 Judy Garland song from Bandstand or Bandwagon. Are you familiar with that song?
I've like heard, definitely it sounds familiar, okay. But I don't like,
well, the page won't let me reload, but so very, I know I don't want to keep beating a dead horse here, but I just find it so fascinating. I think I would be inclined, because the movie takes place in the 70s, I think if they were to use popular songs from the 70s backwards, I think I could get behind that. But if they were to use like current pop songs or even like Lady Gaga songs, I don't see it working. You sound like nothing they can do will make it work, but I at least could work with using songs that the characters, I'm people are probably like, Taylor, you're looking too far into this. The Joker isn't like real 1970s New York, but the first movie is real 1970s.
Well,
you know what I mean? Like,
I think that's part of my issue with getting my head around this. And I think you're right, Taylor. Like, there's very little they can do, because the first movie, to me, feel so tonally the opposite of what they're doing with the second movie that I'm having a hard time understanding the decision making behind that, but also like why you think this enhances the story you're trying to tell. Especially why about not? The Joker, which is a character I know very well.
This is where we've talked about this so many times before, but if you want to make a musical with Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga, knock your socks off, but just like choose different IP or make an original story.
Yeah.
Like that crazy wild idea. Like, why stay in this weird Joker universe? I don't know. Anyways, do you have the release date by chance? Are we getting closer to it?
I don't in front of me. I mean, I can quickly look it up. I think it is this year. Like, where it's supposed to be this year. I just don't know. Okay, October 4th. There you go.
That's, yeah, October 1st, 2024.
That's correct, yeah.
And they don't know whether or not there's going to be original numbers added? What?
Yeah, this movie is coming out in, like, what? 8 months? 6 months?
You know how, like, you know how things work a little bit better than I do, but should they not be already editing the movie?
Generally, yes. Generally. Like, some movies do some post-production shots, but sure. More often than not, a year out from the movie being released,
filming should be wrapped.
Filming, and then there might be some post-production cleanup shot things while they start editing. Because during the editing process, which is usually about a year for any big movie, they notice things being like, oh, we really need this, we really need that. So they often will do reshoots. Like, sometimes big outlets make a big deal about, like, oh, this movie's going into reshoots. What does that mean? Well, they've stopped doing that because every movie does reshoots, because right. It's just part of the process. So I wouldn't be surprised. Like, oh, they're doing a bunch of reshoots right now. Sure. A little late, but not out of the realm of possibility. It's April and this movie comes out in October and they're still filming it. That would be a ridiculous turnaround. I'm sure it has happened in rare occasions where you can have a, you know, 5 or 6 month editing process, but more often than not, it's closer to a year.
This just totally popped into my head randomly. You know what jukebox musical I personally think is quite successful and quite good, but you'll probably disagree with me? Moulin Rouge. That's one that works well, in my opinion, as an average moviegoer. Mm. You can disagree.
Well, yeah, Moulin Rouge is fine. It's fine.
But that wasn't made for... It went to stage after it was a movie, correct?
That's right. Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a movie first. And even the movie itself, like, it was out there and weird and Baz Luhrmann-y. But for what it was, right? For what the plot is and the feel of that movie, that makes sense.
Yes, like, and there,
doing that fits.
I guess the sense that, like, those to me were kind of more top 40 songs in the sense there's, like, I can't think of any other songs for some reason other than the Elton John song they use, but they definitely use more sort of mainstream music, pop kind of, oh, there's a Police song in there. So mm-hmm. I wonder if they're going to go that route, but again, it's such a high camp movie. Like you said, very Baz. So I don't know. We can move on, Mike, and I'm sure we're going to be scandalized further as we get closer to October, but golly, what a headline. Please let us know, fans. Are you dying to see this Joker movie? Are you going to run away as far as you can? Yeah, what songs? That's a fun game, Mike. What songs would you include in your Joker musical? Maybe we can revisit that closer to make our own Joker musical.
I guess this is just one of those films that as the news comes out, there's always going to be something worth talking about on this show. Because sure. It's going to continue to be this ridiculous. So, yeah, I was about to say, can we stop talking about it? But then I feel like we can't.
They just keep amping up. One last point. I feel like no matter what, whatever they do, it's going to be so, so, so hard not to be corny. I guess that's my biggest fear. That however they incorporate the music, whatever songs they use, they're going to be a razor hair away from just being total cheese ball, which is the complete antithesis of the first movie. Although not that we liked the first movie, and the first movie was, I guess, cheesy in a different sense. But we'll move on. We'll go to our reviews. Speaking of cheese, I assume the movie you reviewed was a little cheesy, but maybe I'm completely out to lunch on that one. It looks cheesy.
So, yeah, Ghostbusters. Like, it wasn't really cheesy. It was certainly nostalgia-y. I mean, you can't avoid that with these kinds of movies. And this was technically the second of this kind of new Ghostbusters movies. The
one. Here's a quick question for you, Mike. I saw something online saying, did we really need the 2016 one? Is this a sequel to the 2016 one, or was there a completely different one in 2016?
So what happened? No, they completely rebooted it. So what happened was the 2016 one came out.
The lady one.
That's right. Yeah. Lady Busters came out in 2016. Everybody hated it. They reset and did this reboot like just before the pandemic. Ghostbusters Afterlife came out with Paul Rudd. And now Frozen Empire is a sequel to Afterlife.
Got it.
Which is our second reboot.
Now I understand, based on the hate that the lady one got. I shouldn't be calling it the lady one, but there's people on the internet call it worse things.
I will say the hate it got was deserved,
right?
For what that movie was.
So which people was said, atrocious. But that comment doesn't even make sense. Do we even need the 2016 one? They're commenting on the Frozen Empire one because they're different timelines, yes. You could say.
And no, so the answer is no. We didn't need the 2016 one. We didn't need the Paul Rudd one, and we didn't really need this one either. Like, needs any of this. Ghostbusters was a one-off kind of
franchise
movie that just was what it was. Like, it had its one movie, it had a sequel. It was from a bunch of Saturday Night Live people, and it just was what it was. I think Ghostbusters has a hard time figuring out what it is. Like, it seems to have an identity crisis. It's like, are we a horror movie? Is it an action adventure movie? Or is it a comedy?
Family movie?
Or family movie?
Look like family movies, but maybe.
Yeah, yes. I would say Frozen Empire was a family movie leaning towards action adventure, more so than a comedy and more so than like a horror movie. So there were aspects like in the original Ghostbusters movies that were like horror-esque, but it never really got to a point where it was ever like,
ooh, I'm scared.
Yeah, even remotely uncomfortable. I will say this movie made me laugh a few times. Like, there were a couple lines. This is a movie that's just sort of fine. Like, it's not horrible. It's not great. And it just sort of exists. And it's just fine. And I think because they don't know what to do with it, you get people in the film who feel like they're in different movies. Like, you get this. So this is a family who are Ghostbusters, who are all like the descendants of one of the Ghostbusters, Harold Ramis, who passed away. It's basically his like grandkids. The kid from Stranger Things is one of them, who does nothing in this movie. Finn Wolfhard, yeah. And like, he's fine as an actor, but they gave him like nothing to do. I don't have her name from, I think it's like McKenna something.
She's in everything.
Yeah, she's in a bunch of things now. And she's very good. Like, she's one of those young actors, like, is, you know, charismatic and interesting and like does different things. Then there's these like two other kids that are like their friends, and they are like two of the worst actors you've ever seen on the planet. So they're just terrible.
It's always hit and miss with child actors.
Yeah, and this movie is really hit, miss, you didn't really do enough to judge. Like, that's basically what it was. And I just, I felt like the movie never really chose a direction and chose a lane and stuck to it. It just felt all over the place. And the older Ghostbusters being in it felt just so shoehorned in. Mm. Like, not even as cameos, they were more like more or less just in it and part of the story. And I felt like, especially the two scenes Bill Murray were in, like, just didn't work.
Doesn't
and I feel
he
like
historically not want to do these
that's
movies?
Right. That's right. But like all of us, when you dump a pile of money on the front lawn, what are you going to like?
Of course.
You, everyone says something until there's money involved. And then you'd be fast how people change their tune.
But you were saying he did not do a good job.
No, none of the older ones just seemed, I mean, I'm not going to say they did a bad job, and I'm not really going to bring like their age into it and just say they're too old.
But they weren't excited about
that. Yeah, there wasn't that same
spark,
charisma and natural sort of charm that the characters had before. And it just clearly feels like something's missing and it's not quite there. And I feel like if you were going to do it, the movie was a little bit stronger with the family dynamic. Like, why not just stick to this family? Right, there's a mom who's kind of disconnected, doesn't really want to have anything to do with it. Paul Rudd, who's just like super excited to be there because he's a big Ghostbusters fan. The kid genius and like the other kid who's just trying to like help his sister out. Like if you do those things, like that could be a really interesting movie in the direction and just like leave the old Ghostbusters behind and just go with them. Because where the movie I think was good was those moments. The kind of arc in the movie has more to do with the youngest child, and basically in the first movie it was really, really isolated. They were like somewhere else, ghosts happens, all those things happen, now they're Ghostbusters. So in this movie they're in New York, they're busted ghosts, and the mayor is like, this child is underage and can't be a Ghostbuster. Like, we don't let children be
firefighters. like the mayor would weigh in.
Yeah. Well, in this movie the mayor weighs in. So basically they kick her off the team, and there's this whole arc,
not about the chief her. Police, not the health inspector, it's
no,
the mayor.
No, it's the mayor, who I guess is the same mayor from the first movie, I guess,
because also, well, I guess mayors can, I don't think there's terms of offices for mayors necessarily, like limits, but still. So weird.
Okay, it is very weird that so much time has passed and he's still the mayor. So yeah, it ends up that like she has the arc. She has the really interesting story, and there's a lot of cool stuff that kind of happens there. And the mythos around like the ghost is interesting, but this is the movie felt like an episode of a TV show. Like, here's the ghost of the week. We're going to learn the mythos of this thing, and then we're going to have to solve the thing. Like, to me, movies are supposed to be that extra step above.
Sure.
Right. Like, to me, right now, the way I would look at this Ghostbusters movie is the way to improve it is to go the Star Trek model. Yes, you want it to be you want it to be an episode of your television show, but the best episode you could do and raise the stakes higher so people, there's a reason why it's not on TV. And this, to me, felt like an episode of a TV show more so than it did a movie. Like, even though they tried to make stakes, it never felt like there were any. There were some really interesting like cameos from comedians who had different roles and had varying roles that were all funny, and they had their bits and they had their moments, and it kind of worked in there, and that's where the humor came from. But yeah, this movie to me just, it was fine. It was definitely not as horrible as I thought it was going to be. I would say if you're going to start making a genre of movies, this would fit into that genre of it's a nostalgia movie. That's its purpose. Because it's a little bit of everything. It's a little bit of a comedy, a little bit of action adventure, a little bit of family, a little bit of horror, but really it's about the nostalgia. We want you to remember this movie that you loved when you were younger. We want you to take your kids to this one and enjoy it together. It doesn't quite work for me, but maybe it'll work for other people. I think they should stop making these movies, personally.
Nostalgia movies or Ghostbuster movies or both?
Both.
I'm with you. I'm hearing both. You describe that. It's like, just watch the original with your kids. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would say like nostalgia movies, Ghostbusters movies, new Star Trek, The Joker 2. We could get rid of all those things and the world would be a better place.
Probably.
And again, like I make a differentiation between what Marvel is doing, building a cinematic universe and telling different stories within that, that is different than Frozen Empire. Because I see a lot of things, because I also look at articles, I just don't pay them as much attention. I look at things and people are like, oh, it's the fatigue. Everyone's feeling fatigue from these movies and it's Marvel's fault. No, Marvel's the only one doing it well. Everyone else is trying to build cinematic universes and doesn't know how to do it because they can't tell a good story to save their lives. And that's the problem. So I just think that they should stop and you should focus on, you know, create original movies or spend a lot of time developing what is our Ghostbusters movie and what are we trying to say and what does it mean to be a Ghostbusters movie? Is it a comedy? You can say what you will about the 2016 movie. At least they tried to make it a comedy. Like, they straight up were like, this is going to be a comedic movie.
They hired comedians.
They hired comedians, right? they tried to make it just a comedy. It wasn't remotely funny, but they tried. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire for me, it's an airplane it. I think that there's definitely moments within it that I felt like, oh, that's funny. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, okay, cool, whatever. But I think at the end of the day, if you're going to watch this movie, if you're a Ghostbusters fan, if you want to see what this is about, if you want to follow along the journey with Paul Rudd and et cetera, then I say just watch it on an airplane.
I have two things that I want to say before I'll move on to my review. Number one, I have a Dan Aykroyd fact and Ghostbusters fact for you that I heard on the radio, Mike. Would you like to hear it?
Sure. Is it that he actually believes in ghosts? Because
everyone
knows that, Taylor.
I did not know that. So
everyone knows that.
Maybe our listeners, especially those who don't have a Kingston connection. So Dan Aykroyd has a Kingston connection because he lives in a family cottage just outside of Kingston, which belonged to his grandfather, who was the town doctor or dentist, one of those professions. And the grandpa's side hustle was anytime there was a traveling mentalist or psychic or something of that, paranormal expert, his job was to review their shows for the paper. And then I guess also they used to have seances and things in this farmhouse, and Dan Aykroyd now lives in the farmhouse and claims that it remains haunted to this day. Did you know all that, Mike?
No, I didn't know any of that. I just know that he really believes in ghosts.
Yeah, he believes in them. And apparently Ghostbusters, it was in part sort of inspired.
Yes. And his first draft of Ghostbusters was weird, apparently.
Oh,
and others got involved. Yeah, I watched like a documentary. I can't remember.
People were like, this is a little too spooky, Dan.
Yeah. Well, and it was really like energon pods. And this is what happened. Like, he's got all this like deep, deep lore that gets really more and more ridiculous. That makes you think like, how could you possibly believe in this? But still, there you go.
The screenplay was based on his own theories, which he holds to be true in terms of
the first draft of Ghostbusters was a much more serious film, and then other people got involved and
we gotta tone this down
like this. But it is very much, and it was a passion project of his, and it's something that's important to him. And I know that's one of the reasons why this is still going. But at the end of the day, he's the type of person, Taylor, that takes beliefs to a whole new level.
See, I don't know a lot about Dan Aykroyd, but I find people who've grown up in and around Kingston know a lot more about him than I do. So I guess I have the added benefit of being an outsider. I can tell you much more about Ryan Gosling being a Burlington
guy. Yeah, we us Kingstonians, yeah, we know a lot about Dan Aykroyd.
He's a fixture, I hear.
We don't have much of those, so we gotta talk about someone.
And then the other thing I wanted to mention, Mike, as you were talking about, you know, comic book fatigue and whatnot, you know what I think it's time for? And maybe I'm insane and no one agrees with me. I think we need to go back to historical big budget epics. Like, I'm thinking, you know, the melodrama. For a while in the 2000s, what did they call them? Sandals and Swords?
Sandals and Swords movies.
Not necessarily those, but I'm thinking like 1950s, 1960s, these large scale, you know, it doesn't have to be Bible epics, but like one of my favorite movies.
Like Ten Commandments?
Yeah, Ten Commandments, Cleopatra, you know, these even Gone with the Wind from the 30s. These huge, I think it's time for a revival of those. I think we're ready for it. Apparently, well, according to the guy who makes Dune, young people want to watch four-hour movies anyways.
Yeah, according to the Dune guy. Yeah, and I think like the sort of in between is what Dune's trying to do.
Yeah.
Even I would to go back, Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
It's kind of like fantasy epic because like Lord of the Rings, I would argue, is pretty close to that. Not only in terms of the scale, but like it was the epic go to see movie that year. And I feel like those movies often end up being like that. Where they end up, everyone talks about them.
But I'm arguing we don't even need fantasy. Let's take a break from fantasy because of Game of Thrones. I know you don't believe in movie fatigue or whatever. But
I don't, no.
We have Game of Thrones. We have the new Game of Thrones TV show. The new Lord of the Rings TV show that I know people don't like. Amazon has a show called Wheel of Time, I think. I'm ready for historical epic. I don't need the fantasy. I don't need the sci-fi. Let's go back to roots. I guess you could make an argument that Napoleon was a historical epic and it completely bombed, and that's probably why we're not doing historical epic.
I mean, yeah, but like we have to find. I mean, with history, it's obviously based on something that existed, so technically is pre-existing IP. But what we need is that exact idea, a good story. Whether it's fiction or not, and you can use those movies that you mentioned as inspiration. But what I don't want to see is a remake of Gone with the Wind and a remake of Ten Commandments. And like that's what I fear when you say what you say. The only thing a studio hears is, great, okay, we'll redo those movies. Absolutely.
That's not what I want. That's not what I want, though.
They're not good at knowing what you want. They're not good at knowing what you want. I know.
You need
to tell them.
They recorded what we said, ran it through AI, and now we're getting Gone with the Wind.
Now you get another version of
3020 fighting in space, whatever, right?
Exactly. Because that's what people want, according to whatever they're using. But that's, to me,
software.
Yeah, like to me, that's exactly, you point out exactly the problem. So we technically got it with Napoleon. It didn't do well. I mean, I didn't particularly like the movie. You were better and more happier with it than I was. But like, I think at the end of the day, my argument always is it doesn't matter what the genre is. If the movie is good, then it's going to stick around. It's going to be memorable. It's going to be something that people want to see. And I'm all for it. Like the types of movies you're describing, I'm down. I absolutely want to see those as well. I just want them to be like, okay, what's the Ten Commandment of this generation, that kind of big epic movie, tons of stars in it, is going to sweep all the Oscars because
beautiful
it's epic
costuming.
And it's beautiful. Yes, exactly. But what is that? And we need it to be new enough that we don't compare it to something that pre-existed and ruin it. So I would love to know what that is. I don't know what that is, but it would be great. I'm totally down.
They did Noah. I never watched Noah. I think it was a bit of a flop with Russell Crowe. And then I think Joaquin Phoenix and what's her name? His wife, Runa.
Rooney Mara.
Yeah, she was in Magdalene.
Oh, Magdalene. Yes.
Did that movie even come out?
On Netflix, yeah. Well, at least it's on Netflix now. I don't know if it came up, but I just recently saw, because I think my Netflix has given me Easter suggestions. so I just saw it recently, like, oh,
they were promoting
this, and I went, oh, what, this movie happened? Like, I remember hearing about it, but yeah, she.
So every once in a while, these movies, those genre type of movies are coming out, but I think we need a revival, and I think those movies were a bit of flops, and in my opinion, weren't like those large, rich cinema scope, you know, the sand is bright yellow and that kind of stuff. But anyways,
if you gave me, like, the one exception to this remake thing is if you gave me what you described, Taylor, of this like epic movie, but it was Jesus Christ Superstar.
Woo! Now we're
I'd be down for that. Sure. Like, if that, because to me, that would be, because it's, that even that movie being so good, it's still in of itself an acquired taste because of the way they did it. If they did it in a bit of a different way and made it more like, okay, we're focusing on the Bible epic and we're doing it that way, but like tons of stars are in it. Singing's going to be great. Going to build all these cool sets and everything. I feel like that would be very good. Like, that would be my exception to, well, there's a remake because you can enhance what's already there. You can do something a little bit different as opposed
to it's a musical, so you're kind of used to seeing different different versions of it. You know what I mean? Anyways, like every time you see a stage production of Jesus Christ Superstar, it's going to be different depending on the version, right? The director or whatever. So I'm a little bit, I give more leeway. That's a great suggestion, Mike.
I've got a good one. I've got another good one.
Okay, good. There you go. Keep them coming.
Got another good one for you. Joseph and the Technicolor.
Oh, yes.
So we've never really gotten a movie of that, because what we got was sort of like a film stage sort of adaptation of it. But we never, ever, ever got a movie of that. And that's one of those stories that can go in a lot of different directions because there's so much.
Alive. I'm going to jump in real quick. Prince of Egypt live, like a live adaptation of Prince of Egypt.
That would be another one. That would be if you could do it well and make it that epic. That is another one that's rich with material where you can add to it because of you're going off of stories from the Bible. You can go in different directions, like the journey that Joseph goes on, especially kind of in the second half of it, and the way he travels. You can show all these different lands and what it was like and all these different characters that they meet. Like, yeah, those are all examples of movies that would exactly fit what we're looking for, and they would be epic. And if you could get the stars to be in them, yeah, they would be pretty good.
So that was a little bit of a tangent, timely for Easter, but this, I guess this has become our Easter episode. It will air, I think, just after Easter.
Easter.
Happy Easter to those who celebrate. Blessed Easter to you all. So I will change gears a little bit. And even though I didn't review a movie in the last couple of weeks, I was kind of, every once in a while I get in the mood for a docuseries or a documentary. Longtime listeners of the show will know that I love a good true crime. I've kind of moved away from serial killers in recent years, but ever so often dabble. But anyways, I describe these as true crime. People might not call it that, but crime was committed in these documentaries. Weirdly, both of them are about the troubled teen industry. Mike, are you familiar with the troubled teen industry?
Vaguely.
So for those who aren't aware, this was a whole industry, a whole cottage industry that kind of grew out of 1970s wilderness camps. And if you're like really doing your history, a cult named Synanon and some of their behavioral programs. And so essentially, these are programs where quote unquote troubled youth are sent, and a tough love approach is used in order to, for a lack of a better word, rehabilitate them. And essentially, these companies promise parents that, you know, once the children finish these programs, they're going to be, you know, amazing, dutiful, you know, insert positive adjective. Mm-hmm. And so it grows out of the 70s, but a certain model that is like, which is currently in use, really got traction in the 90s. So two different docuseries. One's a feature-length documentary, so about an hour and a half. That's called Hell Camp, Teen Nightmare. And then the other one I watched is called The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping. And that's a docuseries. I think it was 3 or 4 episodes, about an hour long in each. So Hell Camp is about one of these sort of, I would call it kind of the flagship program, which a lot of the other programs copied and learned from. They essentially say this is the first program of its kind. I don't think that's truly accurate based on kind of what I've learned about the troubled teen industry. But in terms of this specific model, maybe, I don't know. So it follows the, it's essentially about the founder of the camp. And it kind of follows him from the founding of his first camp until essentially his death, like his early death, and about how he keeps getting away with running these camps. Like, he'll set up a camp, it gets shut down. He'll start a new program that gets shut down. For those who aren't familiar, these programs are essentially child abuse. You know, the children are really neglected. When we say tough love, it's like the most brutal kinds of discipline. There's sexual abuse, physical abuse, all of this stuff. And in one of his early camps, a youth actually died. So the documentary kind of, this death happens, and then the documentary kind of shifts gears and talks about how he essentially keeps reinventing himself. I listened to a podcast about deaths involving the troubled teen industry, and I felt like this documentary didn't really do a great job by focusing on the founder of these camps. I felt like it, in a sense, almost minimized the abuse and the deaths involved. Like, from my understanding, multiple deaths have happened in these programs, maybe not specifically his, but like the type of programs. Yeah. So I felt like the documentary kind of, you know, it's almost like, oh, he got in trouble and then he moved on. Oh, he got in trouble and then moved on. So it didn't feel, it felt like this documentary felt very surface level. I'll put it that way. Right. And then the other program, the other documentary I saw, which was the docu-series, for people who like more sort of in-depth slow burn, they'll probably prefer this one. This one is about a boarding school. So a little bit different from Hell Camp. The model is sort of outdoor wilderness style camps. And this one is about a school, a Christian school, but they all fall under this umbrella of the troubled teen industry.
Okay, so this one just happens to take, like, it focuses more on a school.
Yes. And so it's not the same, it's not the same owner, but like it has a lot of a similar methodology, similar ideologies, and it kind of grows out of this same sort of phenomena, I guess you could say. So this one is specifically is about a Christian school, and very interestingly, the documentary maker attended the school, and so the documentary is her and several other of her former classmates essentially going through the abandoned school building, and they're kind of
like in like today
in real time. Yeah. In,
oh wow.
Yeah. Or I don't know if real time is the right way to describe it, but like in current day,
current times,
they're in their 30s. And they essentially are using their school to investigate this company that ran their school, but then also ran similar schools. I thought this documentary was much better than Hell Camp, in the sense of, you know, it really went in depth. It kind of, you know, it's almost like investigative journalism in a sense. I did find, and this, it's hard when the documentary filmmaker inserts themselves right into the documentary, and I appreciate that. For her, this is a passion project and she literally lived it. But unfortunately, I found her personality a little grating.
right.
Which makes it, I'm like, oh, I just wish you stayed behind the camera. Or like you did the interviewing, you know what I mean? But she is a character in the documentary, so to speak, if that makes sense. So that was probably my biggest complaint about this one. I just thought, oh, like, I feel so sorry for you. I feel like you know, I'm empathetic 100% to your story. I just wish you were in front of the camera as often as you are.
That's actually really funny that it's the person who's essentially leading this documentary, and that's the one you can't stand.
Yeah, she just, Mike, you'll have to watch. You don't have to watch the whole thing because I know you're not as hot on documentaries as I am, but like, just watch like the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then report back to me. Because yeah. It's a little cringe. The it definitely has more like a like it feels almost like a investigative series from like the late 90s, early 2000s in terms of style, but like she is maybe a year or two older than I am. So like she would have grown up watching the same sort of like ID documentaries that I would have watched, or you know what I mean? So I can definitely see the style influences. Yeah, so that one I feel, especially because it's a docuseries, it definitely has more time to investigate and kind of follow the trail, so to speak. I think they're both worth streaming it, especially if you're interested in the troubled teen industry, if you're interested in true crime but want to maybe take a break from serial killers like I do every once in a while. I will say, you know, full warning, this does include abuse of children in all capacities. And at some points, there's some vivid descriptions of that abuse. So just, you know, just keep that in mind. If you're not into that, you know, if you're not comfortable hearing that kind of abuse described, these probably are, these are ones that you should skip. But, you know, in terms of docuseries, I found them quite interesting. And then of the two, just again, I found the program more riveting than Hell Camp, especially because I've listened to a long form podcast about the troubled teen industry. I felt like Hell Camp was a little bit more surface. So again, they're both stream its, but keep in mind those troubling aspects of it. It's not going to be for everyone.
Yeah, and I think the subject matter kind of lends it to that. I don't know how.
Pretty obvious.
Yeah, like, I don't know. You'd have to kind of understand that that's going to be part of it. But yeah, I mean, certainly if you're interested in that topic, you would know.
And I just want to say, if for people who are, I know we're running out of time, Mike, I just want to add a little bit of people who are like into pop culture. You're probably into pop culture if you're listening to this show. So the troubled teen industry has really caught people's attention in recent years because Paris Hilton has revealed, I guess you could say, or has shared that she was sent to a troubled teen program while she was a teen. So that has really brought it to people's attention. Dr. Phil was horrible. I don't know if he's still doing this. Was often would send troubled teens from his show to these camps. And we just thought that was normal, I guess, in the aughts. I don't know. Just absolute sheer craziness. And these programs are still operational. I don't know if we have any in Canada. I really hope we don't. Maybe I need to do a little bit more research, but they're still operational in America. They're still hurting kids. And it's just wild. It's wild that these places are allowed to operate and get away with what they do. So if you're interested in that, check out these documentaries.
Very good. There you go. Thank you, everyone, for listening this week.
Go see some movies.